Hello, welcome to the ZX Spectrum. My name's Lindsay Hodgson.
And my name's Brandon Ralph.
And this week, we're going to be chatting to a pretty amazing thinker, a guy called Callum Chase. But last week, we chatted to Liam Berryman about young people and their behaviours and identities online, specifically around social media. Liam's a lecturer in childhood and youth studies. You can check out our conversation with him on iTunes and also a load of other platforms. And to that point, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate and share this podcast. That would be hugely appreciated if you can do that. But on to this week, we're delighted to welcome all the way from Spain, Callum Chase. Callum is, according to his Forbes description, a columnist and author and speaker on artificial intelligence. We've actually had a kind of hybrid podcast with Callum back in February when Callum's Economic Singularity Club, supported by Think Nation, ran a special debate around AI young people and the future of work. So do check that out. Again, it's on our library. But Callum, welcome.
Hi, Lizzie and Brandon. Great to be here.
Do you want to just explain a little bit better about who you are and what you do and what your drive is, why you're doing what you're doing?
Well, I can't improve on your introduction to me as an amazing thinker. I've never been described as that before. It's very flattering. I write books about AI and been doing that since about 2012. And I am really interested in the future of AI. And I have been all my life. And until kind of 2014, most people thought I was completely bonkers. And then suddenly everybody's woken up to AI, quite rightly, because in 2012 there was a big bang and AI started to work in a way that it hadn't done before. The application of machine learning, and in particular deep learning, and perhaps you might want to get into those, mean that AI now makes a lot of money. So people are taking it very seriously. And I'm interested in what that will all mean for all of us, not just in the short term, but in the medium and the long term as well.
So can I just quickly ask, why 2012? Was it something to do with, was it to do with processing power? What was it?
It was to do with processing power, and but the breakthrough was made by a team led by a fellow called Jeff Hinton, who is a British computer scientist who's spent pretty much his whole career in North America, works for Google, as well as Toronto University. He, as I say, he got a branch of statistics called machine learning, and in particular deep learning, to apply to AI. What he actually did was to get a technique called backpropagation to work. Neural nets have more or less been rebranded as deep learning. Neural nets have been around pretty much since the beginning of AI as a science back in 1956, but it was thought they didn't work, and Hinton proved that they do, and that's why, as I say, there was the big bang in 2012 when he made it work, and then since then they've been making a lot of money for people.
Right.
Awesome. So your recent book is called The Economic Singularity. What is the economic singularity? What does it mean?
Singularity is a term in maths and physics, which means a point in a process where a variable becomes infinite. And the classic example is a black hole. At the center of a black hole, the gravitational field becomes infinite. And what happens then is that the rules of physics just stop working. So a singularity is a metaphor, meaning the biggest kind of change, transition, disruption, revolution that you can have. And for quite a while, people have been using the term singularity to refer to the point when we create a superintelligence. So we create an artificial general intelligence, which is an AI with all the cognitive abilities of an adult human. And because machines can be improved in ways which our brains can't, it goes on to become a superintelligence and much, much smarter than us. That's known as the technological singularity. And that will be, if and when it happens, and it almost certainly will, we don't know when, that will be the most important thing ever to happen to humanity. I've deployed the term for an event which will probably happen before then, which is when we need a different form of economic structure because machines render almost all of us unemployable. Now, this isn't going to happen anytime soon. What is happening is automation. We're increasingly getting a new type of automation called cognitive automation. But for quite a while, what that will do is create more wealth and create more demand and therefore create more jobs. And for quite a long time, many of those jobs will only be able to be done by humans. But gradually, and then perhaps suddenly, we don't know, machines will get to the point, presumably, unless we hit a hard wall, where they are able to do most of what we do for money. And at that point, many of us become unemployable and we need a different type of economy. And I've got some ideas what that might be. I wrote that book because I don't think people are paying enough attention to that. There's a lot of denial going on about it. People are looking at the short-term likely impact of automation, which, as I say, is not technological unemployment, and assuming that that will carry on forever. And I think that is potentially a very grave mistake.
With the singularity, are we going to notice it's happening? Is it going to be that kind of like we just absorb it and it happens and we don't really question it and it just happens despite us kind of, you know, realizing too late maybe that it could have a negative impact on us and a positive impact?
Yeah, the short answer is we don't know. Right. I don't think there's any logical reason why a singularity has to happen instantaneously. It could happen very fast. Mm-hmm. There's a big debate about this as regards to the technological singularity. And some people think that there will be what's called a fast takeoff when we get to AGI, that within days or certainly weeks and possibly even hours, we'll have machines on the planet which are hundreds and millions of times smarter than the smartest human. Other people think that the takeoff will be very slow, and you know, one day we'll have a machine which is human equivalent, and then a few years later we'll get one which is twice as smart as humans. Personally, I think it will probably be fairly quick rather than fairly slow. With the economic singularity, I think it's more likely to be slow, at least initially. It might well accelerate. But I think people will see it coming. And the thing that I think will probably be the canary in the coal mine that wakes everybody up and alerts everybody to what may be coming is self-driving cars.
Yeah.
We don't know when they're going to be ready for prime time, but there's a lot of pilots going on. And once they are ready for prime time, once there are cars running around with no human drivers in them, then the process of swapping out certainly professional drivers will probably be quite quick because you save so much money by doing it.
So do you think, like you're talking about kind of like the impact, that's a really kind of clear impact of how the machine will take over a particular job or work with the self-driving car and the trucks and all of those things. Are you talking about work or are we actually talking about tasks here?
Well, actually, that's a very good point. There's three things to distinguish: jobs, work, and tasks. So jobs is work that you get paid for, and tasks are the components of jobs. And what automation does is it removes humans from tasks, but if you remove humans from enough tasks in a job, then the job doesn't exist anymore for humans. Work is something different. We do work for no pay very often. And I think that will go on forever. I think, well, at least as long as there's humans. Humans need projects. We need things to do. Otherwise, we get bored and sort of wither away, I expect. And if we are lucky and get to a world in which machines do all the jobs and we somehow manage to create a new economy in which, nevertheless, everybody is rich, and that needs a bit of unpacking. But if we do manage that, then I think we'll all still do work. We'll have lots of projects, whether it be figuring out how to climb the nearest mountain or create the best work of art that you can possibly create or become the best golfer that you can be and so on. I think we'll always do that, just we won't do jobs.
So what does that mean for the workplace today? You know, how if you're suggesting that it could take a while for this to happen, and yet at the same time, we've got these self-driving cars that are going to happen. I'm with you on that, Callum. It's absolutely going to happen. What does it mean, you know, for people today in the workplace? And also, I think because we are particularly interested in the impact on generations coming through, how can we prepare for that?
I think in the period from now to the economic singularity, what we all need to do is be aware that the world of jobs is going to change probably increasingly quickly, and machines are going to replace us in increasing numbers of tasks and therefore increasing numbers of jobs. So we're all going to have to change jobs, you know, multiple times. If you're starting out in a career today, you can expect to have numerous careers. When I started work, I hesitate to say how long ago, quite a few decades ago, it was not unexpected, and I know people who've done this who spent their whole lives, their whole careers in one company. They did do different jobs as they got more senior, but they spent the whole time in one company. Very few people will do that now. And so people need to get used to the idea that they're going to need to change jobs quite often and probably increasingly often. They're probably going to need to change companies, and they're going to need to retrain and reskill more and more and more and more profoundly. So we need to get much better at retraining people, and we need to get much better at retraining ourselves.
Yeah, I find it really interesting that you say that, because I think at the moment, in definitely in the UK, because UK productivity rates are actually quite low compared to some other countries, is that we sort of have a lack of training and ability to train. I don't think the system at the moment is really built up for like retraining after you've sort of passed university and things like that. And I think we're going to sort of going to hit new problems and new issues with particularly the generation coming up, which is Gen Z, and we look at that sort of heavily. But my sort of, in your book, you sort of say it's up to us, and I kind of struggle with that idea. With is it really plausible that we can, like, the everyday person can actually, and particularly young people who are young at the moment and can't really do too much, can we actually do anything to shape it, or are we just going to end up sort of inheriting what's happening and being sort of not stuck with it, but with no sort of choice around it?
I think a lot of this, you know, a lot of the adaptation necessary to deal with the economic singularity and the change, the period of change which precedes it, needs to be done at a societal level, needs to be done at a government level, and policymakers and politicians are perhaps the most important people to get on board. But that only happens if the population demands it. For a while, lots of people were demanding to get out of the EU, and politicians had to take notice of that and had to do something about it. Another thing which popular demand has driven is concern about climate change. Now, I think if most people, or huge numbers of people, got very aerated about the impacts of automation, the impacts of AI-driven automation, then politicians would have to take it seriously and have to start devising policies to deal with it. So although none of us individually can make that happen, all of us collectively can.
Mm-hmm. Around that, though, politicians work 4 to 5 years in advance, and very rarely do we get politicians who have got the vision to start talking about 10, 15 years down the road. And my concern is that, the groundswell could come from the people, but equally, it's not really in the interest of politicians career-wise to worry about this kind of stuff, and yet very much they should be. These questions should be put to politicians every single day, I think. You know, what are we going to do about AI, employment, all of those things? But they just don't seem to have the knowledge and the understanding around it, and that to me is a concern in itself.
I think that's true. I think most of them don't, but some of them do. Mm-hmm. I'm less cynical than a lot of people about politicians. Most are people of reasonable intelligence, trying to do a good job. And not many people, some do, but not many people go into politics for money. There's more money to be had outside of it. Yes, you might go into politics for ego, but I think an awful lot of them are in it because they genuinely think they can contribute something useful to society. So I'm not that cynical about them. And although, yes, many of them don't know the first thing about all this stuff yet, and even some of the ones who think they do overestimate how much they understand. Mm-hmm. But again, if we demand that they inform themselves and start making sensible policies, then they will do that. And if we don't demand that, then they won't. You know, some politicians have made some quite interesting comments. William Hague, who isn't a politician I particularly admire, but he made some quite interesting comments about the future, the accelerating future of technology, and nobody paid any attention. Now, if that happens, he's not going to do it again because it doesn't do any good. And if politicians run too far ahead of our concerns, then we sack them.
Yeah.
I don't think it's true that politicians can't look into the future. This will be controversial. The UK politicians have actually spent a great deal of public money stimulating renewable energy sources. Now, I think that's a good thing. I think we need to shift from digging up dead dinosaurs to using the sun. That's a really good plan. But they've done it by ramping up electricity prices. And that's not fair, because that means poor people are paying for the R&D to make renewable sources economic. What we should be doing is saying, we want to do this, and then we're going to put it on the tax base, because that's a more progressive way to pay for it. But, you know, over the last few years, an absolutely enormous amount of money has been spent on developing and introducing renewables, mostly through higher electricity prices and higher energy prices. So, you know, politicians can look forward, and they can do quite forward-looking things, arguably not enough, but they're not limited to a 5 to 10 year horizon.
In defence of MPs, I am going to say that I absolutely agree. There are ones that do have that vision. Our local MP down here, Peter Carr, is one in particular. However, what I'm saying is that it's the delivery of that against the will of the people, as it were, because you're saying if the people have to kind of like say, this is the things that matter to us, how do we educate the people in order for them to put the pressure on the politicians to deliver these things? And also, you spoke about the renewable energies. That was with support of the commercial organisations and global corporations. They seem to need to be at the table as well. But if they're creating the stuff that could put people out of jobs, it's this sort of never-ending catch-22, it sometimes feels like.
Because I think it's with, say, politicians, what this is going to lead to, in essence, at least maybe in the short term, maybe, you know, as the economic singularity happens and stuff changes, is it's going to lead to a lot more sort of unemployment and a complete change in what people's perception of jobs and work is. And I think that, you know, it can, governments only function because they collect tax from people. And if people aren't in jobs, or how, I mean, big corporations are infamously good at avoiding tax. If that's where the money sort of starts to centralize and go towards, are we going to start to see sort of governments change and governments not, you know, be able to function in the same way?
I think, Callum, in your book, you spoke about the kind of like future thinking around governments, and you touched on that a little bit, the potential around what governments could be. But you're talking about leveraging this massive change. And what would that system look like? So if we are clearly at a point where we've got to start rethinking the system, surely.
Yeah, well, you've asked a number of interesting questions there. I'll deal with a couple of them. Firstly, what should we all do to inform ourselves so that we can take part in this debate and make sure that the politicians are debating it? And the very short and easy answer to that is buy my books. As to what politicians should be doing, at the moment, to me, the interesting question that they should be asking is, are we heading towards technological unemployment? Are we heading to an economic singularity? And if so, what do we do to make that a wonderful outcome rather than a disastrous one? And I think the short-term policy that I'd like to see implemented is I'd like to see a number of think tanks set up, you know, reasonably well-funded, with people producing papers and people, you know, advancing positions, advancing arguments as to why it will or won't happen and what to do about it. So I think that's what we should be doing at the moment.
And how long would that, you know, how long would that last, as it were? Are we talking sort of like, yeah, if you're talking about the change that's going to come in with the self-driving cars 4 to 5 years, say for argument's sake, within the next 8 years, we're going to start feeling the real, you know, the coalface feel of AI and automation in society. If we're doing papers, how do we respond to the changes that are happening in real world?
Yeah, and I wonder as well, are papers really the best way to sort of get towards your sort of everyday person and start to see the shifts?
And unless, and Callum, please interrupt me, this is about a trickle-down effect, isn't it? This is about informing the people who need to be informed in order to make the decisions that are going to impact on society.
Yeah,
exactly. It's not, I wouldn't say trickle-down, that's got a bad rap, but the debate needs to happen at all levels. You need to have intellectually rigorous, hopefully data-informed, although of course the trouble is there is no data about the future. But intellectually rigorous papers, which mean that the debate isn't just your opinion and my opinion and who knows, you know, whose you prefer is entirely dependent on, you know, do you like the look of somebody's jib? You need to have some intellectually robust analysis and discussion for the general discussion to be well informed. So I'm not suggesting that everybody would read academic economic papers about, you know, what automation is doing today and what it's likely to do tomorrow. But if such papers are being produced, and they are, but not in, not enough, and certainly not enough which take the idea of technological unemployment seriously, if they were being produced, then that would inform the rest of the debate.
I've got another discussion point. You talk about you can't imagine the future as such. We don't know what's going to happen. But some people say, well, we had the Industrial Revolution, and you know, we can talk about that, and things panned out in this particular way. Again, but in your book and in many subsequent talks that you said, you say of the AI revolution, when compared to the Industrial Revolution, it's different this time. Why is it different?
Well, I think it's going to be bigger. And as you know, Lizzie, I get a bit hot under the collar about the phrase Fourth Industrial Revolution, because that woefully underestimates and understates the scale of what's coming. Yeah, the Industrial Revolution was an astonishingly big change. When you look at a chart of GDP over time, it's completely flat until the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and then it gets really much, much bigger. And it isn't just GDP, health span, quality of health, lifespan, education levels, everything takes off at the start of the Industrial Revolution. And as countries industrialize, which China has done, over the last quarter of a century, they suddenly become wealthy. And of course, when they become wealthy, not only does everybody have a better life, they have a happier life, which is true, despite people thinking it isn't. And they also become cleaner as well. Countries go through a now pretty well established cycle of making the place filthy as they industrialize and then cleaning it up when they've become rich and have got the resources to do it. But what AI will do, instead of just giving us a better lever to move things around with, you know, giving us power to move things around with, it will make the environment intelligible, and it will make the environment easier to navigate and to use. And that's going to be an incredible change. And if, as I expect, over time AI also enables us to, in various ways, to enhance our brains, you know, intelligence is our most powerful attribute. It's why we rule the world and chimpanzees don't. We've got a fairly small difference in intelligence between us, and it means that their fate is entirely decided by us, and they have really got no say in it. So it's going to be huge change. It's going to result in huge changes. So I think the phrase the Fourth Industrial Revolution is very dangerous. So you ask, you know, what's likely to happen in the next 5 years and what should be done? Here's a timeline I think is sensible. So at the moment, Google's Waymo spin out, their self-driving car spin out, has a self-driving taxi service. You pay to be part of this program, and then you can use their taxis. There is always a safety driver in them, and Google and the other people, there's sort of 50 or more well-funded organizations, car companies, tech companies and others, developing self-driving cars. They will get to the point where you don't need a safety driver. Now, we don't know how long that's going to take. I reckon 3 to 5 years. Some people think a lot longer, some people think less. Elon Musk goes around saying it's going to be next year, but he's been saying that for quite a long time. But one day he'll probably be right. So let's say it's in the next 3 to 5 years. Then how long does it take to swap out the human drivers, particularly the human professional drivers, who contribute about half the cost of the vehicles they operate? Probably 10 to 15 years. And I say that because that's how long it took to swap out horse-driven vehicles for motor-driven vehicles in cities. So in cities, it's likely that we will have completely self-driving cars and not very many human professional drivers within 15 years, certainly within 20 years. Now, that's going to start happening, as you said, sort of around 8 years. Most people will probably know a professional driver who lost their job in about 8 years from now. So by then, we really want people to have got used to the idea that technological unemployment is a serious possibility. We really want by then to have a corpus of analysis and maybe even some conventional, some not conventional wisdoms, but some consensus emerging over whether it's likely to happen, when it's likely to happen, and what to do about it. So that's what I think we should be aiming for, some consensus about those things within the next decade.
With that in mind, if we are going to be moving towards a different kind of workplace or task, and we're going to be continuously re-educating, needing to be re-educated, what about people who aren't necessarily going to be earning as much money as they used to? Or there's an idea of a universal basic income to kind of counter some of the jobs that might be lost and to give everyone a little bit more of a level playing field. It's got some good points and it's also got some negative points. Is that something that's viable in your view?
No. Universal basic income has a good point. It's giving people money. I'm all in favour of giving people money. It's a great idea.
Yeah.
The question is how you pay for it. Mm-hmm. And universal basic income has some serious problems. And it's a slightly dangerous concept. Firstly, the idea that a payment should be universal is incredibly wasteful. Why on earth would you give money to Rupert Murdoch's kids or Mark Zuckerberg's kids? What a waste of money. Secondly, if the income is high enough to be of any real use, it's going to be incredibly expensive, assuming prices of goods and services remain, you know, more or less as they are now in real terms. And if it's incredibly expensive, and if the way of paying for it, as it certainly is tax, then the rich people will all run away. So that's not a good thing. On the other hand, if the amount of money that is paid out to people is low, then it doesn't do any good. And in fact, the word in the middle of it, it gives the game away. Universal basic income.
Basic.
We've really got to do much better than giving people a basic income. We need a non-universal generous income. I think we need to figure out a way in this post-economic singularity world to make everybody rich. Now, I know that sounds crazy, and I have an even crazier suggestion about how to do it, which is to make the cost of producing everything, goods and services, nearly zero. Not entirely zero, because the market is a very good mechanism for resource allocation, but really, really cheap. And if you can make everything really, really cheap, then the amount you have to tax the rich people to pay everybody else to be rich, or, you know, tax the rich people to make everybody else comfortable, at least, then the taxes don't have to be onerous and the rich people don't all run away. Now, then the question is it possible to get to that world where the cost of all the goods and services is really low? It's known as the abundance economy or the Star Trek economy. And I think it is possible, but it's one of the things that really we need to do a lot of study on. And we need to do it quick, because at the moment, almost nobody is thinking about this. And anybody who is thinking about it is regarded as a loony.
I have a question around that. This concept of abundance and the idea that you make everything, the cost of everything, pretty much zero, that means that energy has to be free. Yeah. At the bottom of all of this, energy has to be free. How will energy ever be free if it is distributed through corporations, and the corporations have, you know, that their whole basis around capitalism is to make money? How do you square those things off? How do you produce things for nearly for free, for people to have for free? How does this system work?
The element I struggle with as well is, to add on to what Lizzie says quickly, is that element that if there's rich and poor people, as you said, and the rich, you know, pay the taxes to sort of help people do that, is how is it in their interest to remain in order for them to remain rich, for them to be giving away like and charging things for next to nothing or for free? And do we need to see a humongous shift? And is our society sort of ready for that shift?
Okay, so three things. Firstly, how can energy be free? Because God gave us the sun. Now, actually, I don't think God gave us it, but it's there. It's there, and it's bestowing an enormous amount of energy onto this planet. So let's use that. Secondly, obviously, there's a cost in collecting the energy and distributing it, and that is done at the moment many places entirely by the private sector, and in most places by a mixture of the private and public sector. I'm a capitalist. I think that capitalism is a very powerful way to make people richer. The market economy is a very efficient mechanism. And I don't think that business people are all just greedy and nasty. I think they do a good job.
I understand the principles of capitalism, but where I'm coming from is I believe in business for good. That's probably where, you know, I you know, this, which is why I'm not probably a millionaire. However, I do understand why we need big corporations and why we need them to create the big money. Where my confusion perhaps comes, or ignorance, or whatever you want to say, is in this world where there is abundance and, you know, everything is created almost for free, how does that stack up with capitalism? How does capitalism work in that? Or are we talking about something completely different that we haven't even invented yet?
Well, I don't know. When we get to the actual economic singularity, I'm not entirely sure. I think for quite a while, capitalism will carry on doing the good work that it does. And, you know, we do need big companies because we need companies with scale, with the ability to fund the enormous infrastructural work that we need doing to collect and transmit enough of solar energy and, in the relevant places, wind energy. And if you have companies with the scale and companies which are genuinely competing with each other, so they haven't rigged the market, or they haven't got cronyist governments taking, you know, big slices of money out of the system, then what that does is it drives the price down. You know, that's one of the great things about capitalism. It provides an incentive to make every product and service better and cheaper. If you make it better and cheaper, then people buy from you rather than your competition. If you make it more expensive and less good, then you go bust. And that's the incentive which will make it possible to collect and distribute energy increasingly cheaply. And this is already happening. The cost of solar cells is on an exponentially declining cost curve. They're still quite high. They're not, in most places yet, cost comparative with digging up dead dinosaurs, but they will be. And we'll get to that point where, you know, as you say, the cost of generating electricity will be nearly free.
What we seem to have spoken about today seems very sort of a Western view. So it's very much like the big countries that are around at the moment, you know, maybe, you know, the developing and coming up sort of superpowers like China. But there's obviously lots and lots of the world that is still in a sort of like what we would consider definitely in the UK in poverty and very far behind sort of where we are at the moment. How can they sort of contribute to the discussion, and what role do you sort of see them playing in the global landscape of the future? Because I worry with everything that you sort of we've discussed today is the element that the rich might continue to get richer, and then is a majority of the population going to be sort of left at the bottom, and what's going to sort of happen to them? And I think that could be particularly apparent sort of in these sort of emerging economies and developing countries.
Yeah, so I'm quite optimistic. Firstly, I don't mind people being rich. I think it's quite a good idea that some people get rich, because they often are the people who create great products and services and they get rewarded for it. The key thing is everybody else getting richer and, you know, hopefully at least comfortable. And that is happening, but we need it to happen faster and with a greater deal of equality. So I don't think the presence of rich people and the presence of increasingly rich people is a problem. It's probably a good thing. Can people all around the world contribute? Absolutely they can. There's a very good, I understand there's a very good AI development community bubbling up in Ethiopia. And obviously there's a huge tech community in China, and you find them all over the world. And I think the big question of what do we do about automation, and what do we do if the economic singularity is coming? That's a problem that will either be solved or it won't. And it will be, if it is solved, it will be applicable globally. Because if it's possible to produce goods and products really, really, really cheaply in America, then there's no reason why it can't be done in Poland and in Congo as well. And technology does diffuse around the world quite fast these days. If you look at the smartphone, you know, it's just a bit over 10 years old. And there's pretty much no place in the world, with the possible exception of North Korea, where if you go to a train station, you won't find people with their nose buried in a smartphone. You know, good new technologies which achieve something useful get around the world very fast. And if we do solve the problem, I think everybody will benefit from it. Of course, if we don't solve the problem, then we're all screwed.
How will we know whether it's panned out positively or negatively? Because, you know, we could argue that here we are in 2019 and we've got some incredible things. life is phenomenally good for a vast number of us. And so you'd look at that and go, well, that's panned out really well for us. But then there's also this idea that we always have this idea that technology or, you know, somehow things we're going to be saved by it. It's going to save us. We're going to sort out the climate change because of technology, things like that. When actually we could have done a lot of these things already. So we have the tech to do a lot of good stuff, but is it the political and commercial will that dictates otherwise? And again, is it, how will we know whether it's good or bad? Will there be these particular markers, or is it just going to be a little bit like the, you know, we'll just all be suddenly bathing in this lovely warm glow of happiness, or will it be, we'll be boiling away in the proverbial, you know, water along with the other frogs? How will we know?
And who says that what's good and bad, and where does that come from? Because good for us could be one thing, but for somebody that, you know, maybe doesn't have enough money to live anymore because they've been put out of a job, is it good for them? How do you find, yeah, how are we going to generally understand, you know, if everything's gone well or everything's going badly?
Yeah, so who defines good is a question which will probably never be fully resolved, but in very broad terms, we all know that if everybody in a country and in the world is richer, that's a good thing. You can quibble about whether we're, you know, it means overusing resources or what have you, but broadly speaking, people living longer, living healthier, being literate, not having to work 12 hours a day at some mind-numbingly and physically dangerous job, that's all a good thing. Mm-hmm. So I think we sort of all have a feel for that. Will it be obvious or will it be subtle? Well, I think it'll probably be quite obvious, because, you know, if the economic singularity is going to happen and we get it wrong, then I think we're in for a very tough time and possibly a short time. You know, if most people are out of a job and we haven't figured out a way to make that economically a good position, then lots of things are going to stop working. And I don't know about you, but if supermarkets stop being packed with food, or if it becomes dangerous for me to go into a supermarket because there's roaming bands of vigilantes just, you know, stealing stuff and beating everybody up, then I don't think I'm going to last very long, because I don't know how to shoot a rabbit and I haven't got a gun. So I think we will know whether it's worked or not, and I think it'll be pretty obvious, and I think we'll have a pretty broad degree of consensus. There's one other thing you said about whether it's bad politics can derail all this. Absolutely. South Africa is such a brilliant case study of this. You know, they emerged from apartheid with an astonishingly hopeful prospect, thanks to the genius of Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
And then Jacob Zuma, you know, one of the all-time villains of history, fouled the whole thing up. And now South Africa is in some degree of turmoil. It's you know, much, much better off than it was under apartheid, but is nowhere near as good as it should have been. Bad politicians can create really, really bad outcomes. And it doesn't mean that, you know, technology can enormously improve our lives. It is probably the most powerful thing in improving our lives. But you've got to have other structural things in place. You've got to have rule of law. You've got to have some degree of justice. You've got to not have President Putin running your country. You know, you need things like that.
So, I mean, it actually, Callum, do you know what it sounds like? It sounds like the human condition is just, if you apply the human condition to the potential of anything, then there are going to be opportunities where it's going to go absolutely phenomenally well. And also there will be, coming to the surface, some terribly negative things. It doesn't seem to me that there's, the difference is this time, however, it could be on a hugely multiplied level. Whereas before, if something bad happened, it could be contained. This could really impact every society on the globe.
And I think it could happen really, really quickly as well. Like, you know, we might have a bit longer with, say, what happened in South Africa to sort of scoot back and do that. Maybe we have 10, 15 years, but could this happen really, really quickly into a point that, you know, maybe if one mistake in policy is made in politics, it has sort of a huge effect and we can't fix it quick enough, you know?
Yeah. What's the point of all this AI? Just because we can, should we?
Well, firstly, we can't stop it. You know, if something interesting and powerful can be created, it will be.
Yes, we
absolutely should be developing it. The upside potential of AI is astonishing. Imagine we do get the economy of abundance. So we have a world in which everybody can do exactly what they want to do at any time and they don't have to worry about money. What a huge improvement that would be in the world. And then later, if we survive the technological singularity and we have super intelligences on the planet which can solve all our problems, we literally could become godlike in the nicest possible way. I mean, there are some pretty bad gods. We don't want to model ourselves on them, but we could, our life opportunities, the life opportunities for all humans could become astonishingly improved, much, much more significant than the Industrial Revolution, even though that was very significant.
My struggle with that concept and idea, though, and it goes back to something you said earlier about how we're the sort of like the height of intelligence on this planet at the moment. We're not that far away. If a super intelligence does come around and is way smarter than us and way better than us, what will our function be to them, you know? And if technology gets built in a way that's, you know, like that isn't necessarily so pro-human as you're sort of saying, is there a consequence where we actually build technology that ends up destroying us? Or, you know, like animals used to roam this planet and now we sort of use them for food. Are we going to turn into food for the robots, so to speak?
I don't think we're going to turn into food for robots. We're not very good at producing electricity, despite the Matrix movie, which in many other ways is a great movie.
I think we might make some good carbon, though.
Well, actually, much better ways to get hold of it than by mincing us up. However, your point is right. The downside potential of a super intelligence which doesn't like us very much or doesn't understand us very well is enormous. And we need to be doing a lot of thinking about how to make AGI and super intelligence safe. And the good news is that there's quite a few very, very smart people working on that project. We've probably got several decades before it happens, so we've got time to figure it out, and there are bright people working on it. We need more of them. They need to be better funded, but there's really good work going on. And there's a very interesting book coming out later this year by a very illustrious member of my think tank. I'm always slightly surprised he's a member of it, a chap called Stuart Russell. He's got a book called Human Compatible coming out, I think, in October. And Stuart writes really, really well for lay people. He doesn't use complicated maths, he doesn't use complicated jargon. And it's a really good book summarizing one way to make sure that superintelligence is safe. So it looks like a challenge that we can meet. But it is a challenge.
Yeah. I think there's a growing sort of view that maybe this sort of AI can be a bad thing. I mean, one thing that jumps to mind is a couple of years ago, Marvel brought out a movie called Avengers Age of Ultron, and within that they had sort of a super intelligence that went bad. And I think there's lots of that sort of going on in culture, which, I mean, I look back to sort of like Star Trek and things like that, which sort of influenced technology of today. I think I'm hopeful that maybe we'll be able to sort of start to see that sort of influence, like the general public's perception in the future.
Star Trek was a really hopeful, positive story, wasn't it? They framed it that it was all possible, and you know, it was a very positive view of the impact of technology on humanity. I think we are also, I guess we're touching on AI ethics a little bit here. And AGI is artificial general intelligence. I think my concern, and I've got to just, you know, I've got to be the, I'll throw the concern point in. you've got two superpowers, one maybe waning superpower, but certainly China and America, they're on a race for it. And this is about domination. So my worry is, if you've got the idea about AGI about the dominating point, that this could be used as the, we will be the superpower, that's where I worry that we can have all the nice conversations we want, and there are some interesting conversations going on, and we can have these ethics and, you know, laws, but I'm not of the opinion, or I'm not reassured enough that actually there are going to be people who are going to follow those, and that's what worries me. This does feel like the Wild West in that point. And that's my concern.
Okay, so I don't think it's a race because there isn't a finishing point. We'll always be developing AI forever and ever and ever. And there isn't a winner unless, you know, one power, one company controls all the AI and has removed everybody else from the AI development sphere. And that's very unlikely to happen. What there is a game, if you like, or it is a contest, if you like. There's a field of competition to create the best AI faster and faster. And it is a big problem that the only players on a global scale in that game is the US and China. I don't think the US is in decline at all. American competitive spirit is still very strong. China is the new rising superpower, but Europe is a superpower as well, economically. And Europe should be involved in the AI project, the AI contest, whatever you want to call it. It's not, and it should be getting into that. Partly because we all benefit from better and better AI, and Europe has a lot to contribute. And that's the other reason why it's not a race, by the way, is that if Google makes a better AI, it isn't only Google or just America that benefits, the whole world benefits. So I don't think it's a race, but I think Europe should step up and start doing more, and I think the rest of the world should as well.
Well, when you're talking about race, I may be talking about AI and use of within warfare. And I think that there is a definitely, from what I've read and what I've looked into, that is a very specific race for the superpowers to have that kind of control. The whole argument of killer robots and killer drones, that's not something that I think it's all going to be fine around. That worries me.
In the military field, arguably it is more of a race because one side could dominate completely. You know, they could, if one side developed an AI which could hack into the other side's, when did everybody else's safety in crucial infrastructures and send armies of bots crawling across the land and sea, then yeah, you could have total domination. You could have terrible, terrible outcomes. So the military is a very special case. There are, broadly speaking, it's worth bearing in mind, technology has always been our most powerful tool to improve our lives ever since we started using fire. It always has a potential downside. If it's powerful enough, it'll have a potential downside. So food can keep you warm and cook your food, but it can also burn your house and indeed burn you. AI is increasingly our most powerful technology, so it has the biggest potential upsides and the biggest potential downsides, and we need to pay attention to both.
If you could give sort of one message to our audience listening about sort of AI, what would it be?
Inform yourselves.
Apart from reading your books, have you got any other people that you suggest for all sides of the argument?
It's such a big subject and there's so many good things that have been produced on it. Max Tegmark's book, Life 3.0, I think, is very good. Martin Ford's book, The Rise of the Robots, Wake Up Call about the possibilities of automation. He doesn't really offer any solutions. I think he gets slightly scared by the scale of the problem. And it'd be interesting to see if eventually he does start coming up with some solutions. If you look on Amazon under AI, there's tons of books. There's new ones coming out all the time. And there's lots in the papers as well, and particularly in the tech press like Wired and Tech Radar and TechCrunch. There's lots and lots of information. It is not hard to find information. It's more a question of deciding to.
And I think also Brandon touched on it with, you know, popular culture. I do think that this will actually start to come into the conversation more, not just around fiction, you know, and films, things like that. I'm expecting to see these conversations start to take place within the more mainstream popular culture. Because I think it has to, and I think that people are starting to feel that those conversations need to be had. Callum, thank you very much. I always feel like I learn so much whenever I listen to you.
That's very kind of you to say so.
We will put your links in under the podcast, but do check out The Economic Singularity. And what was your first book? Was
Surviving AI.
And what's your Twitter handle?
@CCCallum.
We'll put that down below. And for our audience, we'd love you to sort of leave a rating and subscribe. And please find us and get hold of us if you've got ideas for interesting people we should be talking to or tell us feedback about the podcast and how you're finding it or how we could improve it, please let us know. Lizzie and I are both on LinkedIn. You're at lizziehodgson.com.
I'm at lizziehodgson.com.
And I'm at brandonralph.com. As always, thank you for listening.
Thank you, Callum. Thank you, Brandon.
Thank you, Lizzie.
See you next time. Bye-bye.